WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It is often said that Jesus was the most influential human being in history. His influence over the last 2,000 years of Western history and his impact on people, philosophy, and religious thought has been felt around the world. But Dr. James Tabor says it isn't Jesus, but the Apostle Paul who deserves that consideration. Paul, the so-called 13th apostle, the apostle to the Gentiles, a man who never met Jesus, ended up crafting much of what we consider Christian thought and belief today. And that is why Dr. Tabor says that he was mankind's most influential individual. Now, perhaps that sounds controversial, even heretical, but Dr. Tabor is no stranger to controversy. His search for the historical Jesus and his investigations of early Christianity have thrust him into the white-hot heat of a skeptical spotlight before and made him a recipient of some withering criticism in the past. A professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Tabor has released a book on this latest topic, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. And he joins us for the hour. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
I asked you moments ago, when are you going to stop rocking the boat? And you said, this is the end of a trilogy of books, which began with the Jesus dynasty, went on to the Jesus discovery, both of which we have talked about. And now this book, Paul and Jesus, which you said is the most important of the three. Why?
I think it is because you already alluded to my assertion that Paul's the most influential human in history. In the sense of Time Magazine's Man of the Year, we could say the man of the millennia would be Paul.
Or two
millennia, yeah, would be Paul in terms of who really has influenced the world the most. Jesus never wrote anything. We have nothing directly from Jesus. We do have the Gospels, but those are theological presentations of Jesus. And much of what's in the Gospels is actually shaped by Paul. And so it's really unconsciously, I think, when people think of Christianity or following Jesus without attributing it to Paul, they end up thinking of Paul. And so in that sense, I think this book caps the research that I've done for 40 years on Christian origins, by finally dealing with the 13th apostle, not just Jesus and the 12 apostles.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about many of the things you just talked about over the course of this hour. The first four words in your book are these, Paul never met Jesus. Now, that would not surprise most believers, would it?
I don't know. I'll tell you something. Recently, I was at a family gathering, and I mentioned this, and one of the people that had gone to church all of her life said, really? I didn't know that. So maybe really careful Bible readers would know that, but I'm not sure the public knows it.
All Christians know that Paul was originally Saul of Tarsus, who persecuted Christians, had them executed, and one day came to this revelation through a vision that he had on a road someplace and became a convert to Christianity, correct?
Yeah, I think it's in the culture. We talk about a Damascus experience, but just this notion that he claims to represent Jesus through visionary experiences, but he never personally met him is what I want to stress as I start the book.
Well, not only that, it's not this one vision. I think most of us have heard the story of the conversion on the road to Damascus because he was struck by this vision of Jesus, and Jesus told him to follow the path, and he did. But you say that this was not one revelatory vision, but a series of subjective visionary experiences over the course of his lifetime involving, quote, verbal exchanges with Jesus, as well as extraordinary revelations of a nature Paul was convinced no other human in history had received. Those are pretty big words. That's a pretty big thought. I mean, that's a big ego going. I mean, if it's not true. But if it's true, I'm not even sure what the question is here. Why would people believe that of him? Here's a guy who persecuted and executed Christians, and suddenly he says, Jesus has spoken to me like no other human in history.
There's a sense in which Christianity is founded on that claim. As it develops, certainly it is. Let me start this way. When Paul first encounters the apostles that had met Jesus, this would be James, his brother, Peter, of course, and John. This is probably 17 years after his conversion. He goes up and meets them and has a conference, and he says, the so-called pillars of the church, what they are means nothing to me. And then he says, because I receive my gospel not through men or from men, but from a revelation of Jesus Christ. So from the very beginning, he sets that as his foundation, that I talk to Jesus. And in his letters, this comes up again and again. He'll say, I receive from the Lord and now have given it to you. And he means, I got it from Jesus. He talks about the abundance of revelations that I've received in several of his letters, so much so that he says it could make me proud. It could make me arrogant. He actually mentions the very thing you mentioned. But then he said, I also got a thorn in the flesh that sort of beats me back down again. And I don't know if have you ever thought about that thorn in the flesh? We don't know what it is, but it's something maybe people have speculated, an ailment or some kind of infirmity, a handicap. I mean, all sorts of guesses as to what it might be. But that thorn in the flesh that pulled him down and humbled him is contrasted with this greatness of his revelation.
So he never met Jesus, and it wasn't until years after Jesus' death that Paul met Peter and James. James, the brother of Jesus, which I knew nothing about growing up, nothing until I met you, actually. And you've done a lot of investigation into James, the brother of Jesus, and the family. In fact, Jesus had many brothers.
Well, yeah,
sisters.
He had four brothers that are named, at least, and James was the leader of the group, along with Peter and John, after Jesus' death.
James was the leader of the Christian sect of Judaism in Jerusalem after Jesus died, not Peter.
That's correct.
All of this is in the book, and you also go into the what makes this significant, what makes Paul significant. One of the things that makes Paul significant is the fact that he probably played a role in suppressing what we would call the Holy Family and their contributions to Christianity in the early days. They were wiped off the planet for the longest time.
I think in his own lifetime, James was so towering. I mean, we've lost the sense of what it was like back in the first decades. This is James, the brother of Jesus, in charge of everything, with Peter and John assisting him, really. So in his lifetime, I don't know that Paul was able in any way to wipe James out or overcome James. What I say in the book is Paul's triumph is really a triumph of his letters. We have these 13 letters of Paul that make up the bulk of the New Testament. And that literary triumph, you know, once in the 3rd, 4th, 5th century, you have the New Testament bound together as a codex, as a book. Mm-hmm. And those, you read the Gospels as you start, but there very quickly you get to the book of Acts. And it's called Acts of the Apostles. It really should be called the Acts of Paul because it's a heroic story of Paul. By chapter, 8 out of 21, out of 28 chapters, you've got Paul, all the way through, and then Paul's 13 letters that follow. So the influence of Paul in the average person's Bible as they turn to the New Testament is just overwhelming.
And who wrote the book of Acts?
The book of Acts is attributed to Luke. It's a two-volume work, Luke and Acts. And Luke is, most historians aren't so persuaded that the Luke in the New Testament wrote Luke. But certainly a Pauline devotee, somebody that's very pro-Paul.
How do you explain that? Because he met the apostles, as you say, years after Jesus' death, and he said some not terribly flattering things about them and about his attitude toward them. So why would Luke become a devotee?
Well, Luke is a Gentile, we think, the author of Luke-Acts, and really wants to propose a vision of the faith in the future for the Roman world. And clearly for that, Paul is the hero.
Okay.
You really finally have a separate religion that you could properly call Christianity that the Romans would recognize.
Right.
It comes down to what the Romans would recognize. As long as a group is a Jewish sect, then it would be like the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, and then you'd have the Nazarenes. But once it goes on the road and goes out into Greece and Italy and Asia Minor and begins to spread in the cities of the Roman Empire, you begin to say, well, what is this group? They seem sort of Jewish, but they meet separately. They're not in the synagogue. And they're following a Lord or a God, Jesus, a divine Son of God. And so slowly it begins to separate, I think.
Given Paul's influence that you uncover in this book and that maybe many people knew about or knew about it intellectually but didn't give it much thought, that the Christianity that they practice is really the Christianity as defined by Paul as opposed to the Christianity defined by Jesus. Why are the Gospels Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, not Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul?
Meaning why didn't Paul
do a gospel?
Yeah. You know, again, I think it has to do with his life. We're looking back on it, but in his time, James, Peter, and John are the towering figures. The movement, let's call it, not really Christianity, but Christianity before Paul, if you want to call it Christianity, it's a Jewish movement within Judaism. It's headquartered in Jerusalem. And so Paul is really not thinking, I need to write letters. He thinks the end is very, write a gospel. He thinks the end is very near, and his letters, you can tell, are dictated. They're literally dashed off. I don't mean they don't have thought in them, but they have that kind of hurried feeling to them. They have his emotions. They have his passion. That's why they're so valuable to us as literature, to have these actual copies of a leader like this who's spouting off this and condemning an enemy and praising a friend, and they've got that live quality to them when you read them. A gospel is a more settled work that you would do much, much later as you think, you know, the end might not be coming for a decade or two or 50 years or 100 years. We don't know. We have to now sit down and present our story. And Paul is just on the road. You've got to picture him reacting to the latest crisis, moving here, moving there. He's a strategy person. He's trying to survive. And so I think he dies in 64, James dies in 62, Peter dies in 64 A.D. So in the 50s, which are the letters of Paul, we're just in a different period. Nobody has any gospels. Nobody's thinking anything will last beyond another 10 years or so.
Because the end is coming?
The end is coming. Mm-hmm. Paul tells people in 1 Corinthians, look, even if you're an engaged couple, don't necessarily go ahead with the marriage because the appointed time of the end has grown very short. I was telling my students this the other day. We're studying Paul this week. Imagine telling, you know, somebody says, we're probably going to get married next summer, maybe summer after, but the end is so imminent that Paul's even saying, you might want to hold off on that because times are going to be very troubled. He tells people that are single, don't be married. If you have to be married because of your own sexual desires, he says, then it's okay. It's not a sin, but I would advise you not to. So he thinks the end is in his lifetime. He often says, and we will see the Lord when he comes.
Well, given the fact that he was wrong, why did it take hold? Why did his version, his message, take hold?
Well, you know, all of early Christianity, including, I think, the Gospels, are still part of an apocalyptic mindset, an apocalyptic movement. And just like apocalyptic movements today, they don't necessarily fade with temporary failures. They have ways of reinterpreting, of recasting the end, and so they were able to hang on in that way.
Dr. James Tabor is a professor of religious studies and chair of the department at UNC Charlotte. He's the author of Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. We will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Voices' 58th annual Singing Christmas Tree and the Singing Christmas Tree for Kids, featuring a 32-foot twinkling tree, holiday music, the Gray Seal puppets, Santa, and more. December 8th and 9th, Ovens Auditorium. Details, carolinavoices.org. And Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years. Shoppers can experience the difference this holiday season at Donald Hack Diamonds across from South Park Mall or donaldhack.com. Ask yourself this question: am I a good American? Well, then there are things you should know about your country, like where the country got its name, why we celebrate with fireworks on the 4th of July, and the original intent of the Pledge of Allegiance. There's lots more to know. People who come to this country have to take a test. So we're going to give you a test tomorrow with two authors of a book, All the Stuff Every American Needs to Know About the Country, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, the Senate considers a bill to allow federal agencies to access electronic messages, balancing privacy rights and public safety.
That's the conversation on the Ian Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. James Tabor, our guest, author of The Jesus Dynasty, The Jesus Discovery, and now Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. He'll be signing that book tonight at Barnes & Noble at 7 o'clock in the Arboretum. If Paul put his stamp on Christianity, and it is his stamp that we really regard as what— that's not the way to say it. The Christianity that we regard as being Christian today is Paul's brand of Christianity. What was the Jesus movement like in Jerusalem before Paul and even during Paul? Because they were two separate movements, as you characterize them. What was it like?
You know, if you think of the Apostles' Creed, have you ever noticed how it jumps from the birth to the death of Jesus mm-hmm. in one sentence? I mean, most of us maybe can't recite it exactly, but born of a virgin, crucified, mm-hmm. Died and buried. That middle part, you just skip Jesus' life, mm-hmm. what he taught, what he was like, is what is really missing. It's not as though Christians don't have it at all, because in the Gospels we have it, but it's so overlaid with the theology. There's the creed that Christians recite. You don't need to say anything about his life, just that he was born of a virgin, that he died, that he was raised, that he'll come again.
That implies his divinity.
That implies his divinity, and it becomes the way you define a Christian. A Christian is somebody that believes Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Mm-hmm. He died for my sins. He was raised from the dead. Mm-hmm. That's all Paul. Now, how do you get to Jesus? Well, within the Gospels, there is embedded a collection of his sayings. They're well known to people. For most liberal Christians, they are the social gospel. Love your enemies, turn the other cheek. If you have two coats, give to the person that has one. Share what you have with the poor. You know, all of those ethical things. And really, in the New Testament, the letter of James. People don't read the letter of James. Remember Luther called it a right strawy epistle, meaning Paul's letters are like meat. And then you get to James, and it's like chewing, you know, some sort of overcooked vegetable or something. It's strawy. It doesn't have a lot of nutrition to it. But if you read the letter of James, the brother of Jesus, in the back of the New Testament, that's the kind of Jesus message,
so,
I think.
So for people who are not scholars and who don't take your classes and have not read this book, had that brand, James's brand of Christianity, what the Jews who followed Jesus, if that brand had taken over as the worldwide brand that we now know, what would be different? What would we be thinking about Christianity today? How would Christians be practicing? What would they be thinking? How would they be acting?
I think, as the Rabbi Abraham Heschel said once, we wouldn't have needed Reform Judaism, meaning that Jesus came and put forth a brand of interpretation of the Torah, of the Jewish law, and of an approach to life that in many ways is echoed in some of our more modern ways of looking at Judaism. not so much in terms of the Enlightenment, but in terms of internal, not external, caring for the individual, works of righteousness, which many rabbis have emphasized. So you would have a form of Judaism. In his own time, it would have been an apocalyptic sect, a highly apocalyptic sect, because Jesus also talks about this generation will not pass until all these things come about.
Did James, did Peter, did the other 10 apostles believe that Jesus was the Son of God?
I think they did, but Son of God to them was a title that's used in the Hebrew Bible for any Messiah. David was a son of God.
Let me rephrase it. Did they believe he was divine?
I don't think they. If you look at the book of James, for example, he's called the Lord, the Master, but no titles such as Paul used.
And so Paul is the guy who put the stamp on it. Paul is the guy who says Jesus is God. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is this new branch of God-like beings that will develop out from Jesus through the flock of believers.
Yeah, now, my colleagues argue this. As you know, you've had Crossan, Dom Crossan, you've had Bart Ehrman, you've had many other New Testament scholars on here. We don't all agree as to how Jesus first was divinized and became the Son of God. I would argue that it does start with Paul. Now, the James followers and the Peter people, they certainly thought he was raised from the dead and exalted to heaven, but they—
Physically?
How they understood the—I think more what we would call spiritually, because, you know, that gets into the nature of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. But what Paul begins to do is to put Jesus in the place of the one God, not as the one God, but going through him. He says things like, we bow the knee. And in Judaism, if you bow the knee, you bow the knee to the one God. And Paul in his letter says, no, we bow the knee to Jesus. And so this idea of worship is very, very early in the Christian community. And I would argue that it does certainly get popularized with Paul in a different way.
You said that once Paul met the other apostles, he had some not particularly nice things to say about them. How did the other apostles feel about him? Do we know?
We don't really know. We have a late letter attributed to Peter that we are not sure. Most of us don't think Peter necessarily wrote it as an autographed copy, but he does refer to our beloved brother Paul, who sometimes writes things hard to be understood. So that would be a charitable way of saying, you know, be careful with this person, even in that tradition. And James seems to refer to Paul in his letter when he says, look, if anybody comes and tells you you're saved by faith and not works, that's crazy. Mm. Faith without works is dead. And so we think the letter of James is referring to Paul. But we don't have the other side of the story, you understand? We have the letter of James. We have some of the original teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, but then the letters of Paul are so dominant that we don't have, it's like a telephone conversation where you only got recorded one side, Paul's side.
Yeah.
But he's yelling and he's upset and he's saying things, as I quoted, like, to say about the apostles, I went to see the pillars of the church, the so-called pillars, what they are means nothing to me. And then to say, because I didn't get my gospel from man and I don't follow Jesus after the flesh, is all implying that that other side simply knows the human Jesus.
Yeah.
And he now knows divine Jesus.
I wanted to ask you about that because his is the version that took hold. And here's a guy who never met Jesus, who makes it a point of pride that he did not receive his knowledge of Jesus through other men, and certainly not through Jesus in the flesh, only through revelations from Jesus, visions of Jesus, transmissions of Jesus to him personally over the course of time, someone he calls the heavenly Christ. Why would he and those who followed Paul find those revelations to be more important, more valid, than those that would come from men who walked with Jesus in life?
Well, I don't think Paul's groups out in the Asia Minor and Greece and all the way to Italy and beyond, mm-hmm. if he ever made it to Spain, they never met these original apostles. So Paul is their conduit. Paul is the one that brought them the message. And it is what we would call today a Pentecostal charismatic movement, so that we get in his letters that the experiences these people are having are very much also spiritual experiences. They're having visions. They're speaking words of the Lord. And so the church at Corinth is the best example that we have. It sounds like a really wild and crazy place. He talks about people interrupting each other and people exclaiming things under the Holy Spirit and speaking in tongues and working miracles. Whereas back in Jerusalem, you get the idea that it's more a rabbinic kind of a feeling. Mm-hmm. Like James sits there and makes judgments, and they talk about the tradition, you know, of the elders and so forth. Whereas Paul, it's out in the wild, it's a spiritualism kind of experience. So I don't think those followers ever contrasted it and probably never experienced that Jewish side.
This is still going on today.
It is.
The mainline churches are withering, while churches that encourage this kind of wild and crazy behavior, as you characterize it, participation, music, things that really we don't think of as sitting and folding our hands in church and listening to the preacher preach, are flourishing. Those churches are flourishing. So this started with the very beginnings of Christianity.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, I'll retract the wild and crazy, because I don't want to offend people who have right. sincere spiritual experiences. But if you just took a videotape
right.
of a Pentecostal service of the most heightened type to an outsider, let's say, who's not mm-hmm. initiate, like the Romans in the time of Jesus, it would seem pretty crazy.
Okay. He himself claimed his own revelations direct. Paul says this. You say his own revelations directly from the heavenly Christ are more significant than anything Jesus taught in his earthly life, and thus superseded the experiences of the other apostles.
Whew. It's like who has the latest word, you know. Remember when we did Waco? It's almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
David Koresh never had a Paul. He's gone, doesn't have any followers left. The movement has pretty well died out. But if somebody came along today and started saying, I'm talking to David Koresh, mm-hmm. and now he's saying this and this and this, just as an example, you see how that could then be claimed to supersede anything.
Yeah.
In other words, I've got the latest word. I spoke to him this morning, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. And there was also the idea in the Gospels that Jesus was not able to give the full revelation, that he was going to his own, the Jewish people, and now Paul is taking it to the whole world.
And is that part of why this has caught on? Because in the Jewish tradition, most people remained Jews. Even the people who followed Jesus thought of themselves as Jews. Paul's job is to take this message to the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people, and there are a heck of a lot more of them than there were of Jews in the Holy Land. So is that why it took hold? Because he had a wider audience and he crafted the message in a way that spoke more to them than the James message spoke about Jesus to the Jews?
I think so. Paul's, he shaped it in such a way that it could appeal to all nations. He had a passion and a conviction that he was supposed to go and take his gospel, as he called it, to all the world. We don't have evidence in the New Testament that James and Peter and John and the others in Jerusalem had that worldwide vision. They did allow non-Jews into the movement, but it wasn't their emphasis.
Right.
In fact, in Galatians, Peter says, I'll go to the Jews, and you go to the rest of the world. That was the division that they uh-huh. came up with, which is a little one-sided in terms of numbers.
Well, there's this peaceful coexistence because of that. I'll go to the Jews, you go to the rest of the world. And yet, you say that Paul made a decisive, bitter break with the first apostles, promoting and preaching views that they found to be utterly reprehensible.
In his letters, particularly the letter of Galatians that Luther liked the best, you have, I think, a break with anything that could be called Judaism. When you began to talk about a new people of Israel, of the Spirit, not the flesh, So if somebody is Jewish and has a Jewish child, you would say, well, you're Jewish, in quotes, but you're not necessarily Jewish in the eyes of God because you need to have Christ. So you're redefining the Jewish people. You're redefining the Torah, not as the five books of Moses, but he calls it the law of Christ. We're no longer under the law of Moses, we're under the law of Christ. And he contrasts Moses with Jesus so that Jesus is superseding Moses. And also, if Jews do one thing, they don't think another Jew is God, right? I mean, that's an old Jewish joke, that we've made a lot of mistakes in our history, but we've never thought one of our fellow Jewish people was a God. And I think for Paul to begin to exalt Jesus and think that he was this heavenly one that sits at the right hand of God and so forth, that also was a step away from Judaism. So that when you put all that together, a different Jewish people, a different Torah, and worshiping not only God but his son, it takes one out of the comfort zone in terms of Peter, James, and John.
And yet if you go back to the Catholic Church, which I know is not the first Christian church, but it's the first one to really take hold and control most of the Western world for 1,000 years or more, Peter is considered to be the founder. He's the first pope. He's the first bishop of Rome. Although, and I think he died in Rome, but I don't think he founded the Catholic Church, although that's what you learn in early childhood Catholicism. Where's Paul in all of that? Because you say that the Catholics have adopted Peter and the Protestants have adopted Paul.
Yeah. Well, if you go to St. Peter's and you face the Vatican, I'm sure you've been there.
Mm-hmm, I have.
On the right is Paul and on the left is Peter. Mm-hmm. And so in most of the Catholic imagery, you have Peter and Paul, Peter representing the founding of the church and Paul taking it to the world. So they keep them kind of side by side. The missing person is James.
Yes.
You will not see a statue of James.
Upon this rock I will build my church, the rock being Peter.
Being Peter.
Where was James in all of that?
That
James took over after
Jesus
died.
A quote from Matthew, which is a pro-Peter document written much, much later, probably in the 90s, 30 years after Peter's death. And that represents a segment of Christianity that is beginning to gravitate toward Peter, not James. It does represent a move toward a more Pauline or Paul version of the faith, so that Peter really becomes very much like Paul. They're twins, one representing the founding and one, you know, if you really look at the traditions, I cover them in the book about what we know of Peter in Rome, it's almost nothing.
Right.
We have a legend that he died there. But as you said, as far as being there and working and being the pope and founding the church and sitting and ruling for decades, there's nothing like that. That's more just tradition and legend. And
you say that for Paul and his version of Christianity, the resurrection was central. You quote Paul as saying, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. And yet I've spoken to many people in the Jesus Seminar, people who are searching for the historical Jesus, who say that Jesus did not rise from the dead and it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So who's right on that point? Does it or does it not?
Well, as you know, I have an entire chapter on Paul's view of the resurrection. And what I argue in the book is that Paul is not concerned with the dead body of Jesus, that he talks about shuffling off the body like old clothing and the new body. And he makes explicitly the point that Jesus has a spiritual body, not a physical body. And so Paul's understanding of resurrection is very different from what many Christians today would have when they think of a resuscitated corpse. And I think that's where you're getting the conflict there.
Dr. James Tabor is author of Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity, and we will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Hendrick Acura in Charlotte, introducing the all-new 2013 Acura ILX compact luxury sedan, fuel efficiency, and available hybrid technology at the push of a button. Details at HendrickAccurate.com. And Cole Genest and Stone, land planners, landscape architects, civil engineers, and urban designers for some of Historic South End's projects, including Camden's South Line. Details at ColeGenestStone.com. The Senate considers a bill to allow federal agencies to access electronic messages, balancing privacy rights and public safety. The topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes. You can join our conversation with Dr. Tabor right now, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or charlottetalks@wfae.org. And by the way, there's a book signing of his book, Paul and Jesus, at Barnes & Noble at the Arboretum, 7 p.m. on the 29th. That's today, tonight.
This is Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. Next time on the show, we ask the question, who was James Beard? We talk to those who knew him best and find out why his legacy matters today. We'll also be tasting wine, learn the secrets to a meal fit for the holidays, and of course, we'll be taking your calls to answer your cooking questions. Join us next time for America's Test Kitchen from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Sundays at 3 at 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The water is choppy today because Dr. James Tabor's with us, rocking the boat. He's a professor in the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte and the author of many books, the latest of which is called Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity, which essentially lays the case out that it is the version of Christianity created by or put forth by Paul, that is the version of Christianity we think of today, that we practice today if you are a practicing Christian, and not the version of James, and therefore not the version necessarily of Jesus. You write that Paul believed Jesus was the firstborn Son of God, a flesh and blood human, but appointed by God as the first in a new genus of spirit beings, an expanded cosmic family, an example of God reproducing himself. Explain that.
Well, this is probably the most astounding thing in the book. If you read Paul carefully, everybody knows he exalted Jesus, but he says Jesus is the firstborn of many brothers. And we could add sisters, but it's not a sexual future. Neither male nor female in Christ. It's this new creation, he calls it, where you'll have a spiritual body, a glorious body, just like Jesus Christ has, and you are therefore divinized yourself. Jesus is always the elder brother, but there's this whole family of glorified spirit beings at the coming of Christ. He even describes almost like a videotape picture of what'll happen. He says the dead will rise and instantaneously attain this new glorified body, and we who are living, notice he says we, because he's expecting to be alive when this happens, will be caught up in the air to meet the Lord and get transformed into this new body.
Let's go back to the time of Paul. Yeah. There were very few Christians at the time of Paul, and very few past Christians who had passed on in the time of Paul. So how many of these people were going to rise to these glorified bodies in the time of Paul? Would it be everybody who had passed on in years prior, the Jews, the Gentiles, people who didn't believe in any gods whatsoever, the Romans? Would they all rise to these glorified bodies in Paul's mind?
He doesn't explain fully what he thinks about this, but it sounds like he thinks there are two resurrections, because he talks about when Jesus returns, the dead in Christ will rise.
So these are the believers.
That sounds like the believers. Now, you're right. That, you know, could that be 100, 200, 1,000 people? It's certainly not all of humanity.
Right.
But he also, as a Jew, I think, we would assume, he doesn't talk about this, assume that in the future, after that initial resurrection, there would be a judgment of all humankind in which all the dead would stand before God. So it's kind of a two-step process.
You say that one of Paul's innovations was the eating and drinking of the body and blood of Christ in the form of bread and wine at the Eucharist or Holy Communion. You say no parallels exist in any Jewish source of the period, that three of the four New Testament Gospels recording Jesus' Last Supper based their accounts of Jesus saying, "This is my body, "This is my blood," and his admonition to eat of his body and drink of his blood was taken almost word for word from Paul, and that as a Jew, Jesus would have considered that sort of language, even symbolically, as utterly reprehensible, akin to magic or ritual cannibalism. So Jesus didn't say those things? Where did Paul come up with this and why?
Well, we have to go by our sources. Our earliest source is a letter of Paul, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and he says, "I received this from the Lord, and now I'm giving it to you." He doesn't say, "I got it from the apostles before me." And then he presents this scenario of taking the bread as the flesh and the cup of the wine as the blood. And that gets picked up word for word in the mm-hmm. Gospels. And the Gospels, particularly Mark is the first, is a very Pauline Gospel, if you want to make an adjective out of his name. It is a Gospel which supports this notion. And then Luke and Matthew simply pick that up. Now, we have another source, though. It's called the Didache. It's not in the New Testament. It was discovered in the late 19th century. That has an alternative ceremony of the bread and the wine. It's Christian, with nothing of that, simply more like Judaism. The bread represents the wholeness of life and the wine, the joy of life and the seed of David and so forth. And so I think we can say that that ceremony, which took hold in the Christian church worldwide, comes from Paul. He says it did. He said, "I received this from the Lord."
Mm-hmm. So at the Last Supper, those things did not happen? Jesus did not say those things?
We have this, as I said, this document, the Didache, mm-hmm. that might preserve a non-Paul version of what was said. But as far as what Jesus actually said, we have no access to it. I mean, if in the Gospels we only have the Paul version, that's what we're left with. So can I absolutely say he didn't say it? I think given the historical context that you refer to, as historians, we could assert that. Because Jews, even symbolically, you know, to drink blood and to eat flesh, you're in the world of the mystery religions. We have magical papyri that talk about eating the flesh and drinking the blood of Osiris or Isis. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing like that in rabbinic literature.
Would that have been put in to help Romans identify with this kind of religion?
It is most often identified with what are called the mystery religions, where you, by eating symbolically or even literally, depending on your interpretation of the Mass and the Lord's Supper, the body and blood of the God, you imbibe the God, you take the God into yourself, you become one with the God. That's the kind of ceremony that we know in some of the mystery religions. Mm-hmm. And so I think for Paul, I don't think he just makes it up. I think he's convinced that this is what he's received.
Okay.
You know, I'm not going to, judge his sincerity and say that he just sat down one day and said, "I'll say that Jesus gave me this." I think we have to take him at his word. He's having these experiences, these ecstatic experiences. He says, "I don't even know if I'm in the body or out of the body when this happens to me, when I get taken over with these experiences." And I think we have to grant him a certain sincerity given the persecution he was willing to endure.
Okay.
He's not a con man. He's a devotee.
Russ in Davidson writes, "In my humble opinion, Dr. Tabor is misinterpreting the New Testament and then presenting his views on Jesus and Paul as facts held by most scholars. He possesses an awesome intellect and is a convincing communicator. For that reason, I truly regret the impact he may be having on his impressionable young UNCC students," who are listening, by the way, "and the listening public who are not well-read concerning the Bible. I also sense that he may either be an atheist or agnostic, which would certainly color his interpretation."
Well, I would suggest, is it Russ?
Yes.
Russ should try reading the book because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. I could call this book Paul in His Own Words. When you finish this book, you will have an accurate account of what Paul said, claimed, did. Now, whether you think that is valid or not will be your choice, but I don't think you will find anywhere in the book that I misrepresent Paul. You just got to try it out. But it is not a Paul-bashing book. It's a book that presents Paul. And yes, I think it's in contrast to Jesus. As far as my own personal beliefs, you know, as a state, at a state university, as a professor, I'm chair of the department. I don't think it's relevant to what we do. You know, none of us, if we're Islamic or atheist or Christian or Jewish or nothing, it's not relevant to what we teach. We want to present the historical account of whatever religious traditions we cover as objectively as possible.
So you're not preaching from the pulpit a point of view. You are presenting the historical record.
I really, you know, in the my classes listening to this broadcast right now, and I'll talk to them next week about it, but I think they would agree that I am extremely fair with the sources, and we try to look at the sources and see what they actually say. And we study them very carefully, word mm-hmm. for word, and analyze them bit by bit. And we have some pretty hard exams where we analyze this material at a very high level.
Okay. Mohammed in Charlotte writes, who decided to put Paul's letters in the New Testament? Why and when? How can Christians today justify the authenticity or accuracy of the Bible, I guess the New Testament Bible, if it is made up mostly of letters from Paul? And you did say that Paul has a considerable influence. I think in the book you say that Paul has a considerable influence on the content and the order of the New Testament.
That's right. James is in the back. You can hardly find it. People have hardly read it. And Paul has 13 letters. James has one. Now, Paul is gone when this happens. This happens in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. And when we say who did it, no one person put together the New Testament and bound it together, certainly not in leather, and started, you know, presenting it in this way. But it gradually developed. I think in many ways it's survived, what we had. In other words, we don't have anything from Jesus directly. We have the four Gospels. We don't have 13 letters from Peter or from James that we can compare. Either they didn't write or that material was lost. And so the New Testament finally becomes a collection of our earliest surviving documents. Occasionally we find others. I mentioned the Didache. You've heard of the Gospel of Thomas. Mm-hmm. Had programs on it. But often those are from a later period. You know, maybe the 2nd or 3rd century. So really, the New Testament is all the 1st century literature that we have.
Perry writes, as a Jew, I've always noted the parallels of the Immaculate Conception to the Hellenistic myths. Do you think that Paul suppressed the Holy Family to make the idea of Jesus as the conceived Son of God more salient to the Greeks to whom he was pushing the idea?
Yeah, good question. It's hard to know because he doesn't. Paul never mentions the virgin birth, and scholars even debate whether he believed in it, because the virgin birth comes to us in Matthew and Luke, which are written 30, 40 years after Paul's death. So it's not clear to us in Paul. Paul's writing in the 50s A.D. That would be decades before the Gospels. So we're not sure as early as Paul if followers are preaching the virginity of Mary and so forth. That could have been a later development. Mm-hmm. He never discusses Jesus' father or mother. He says Jesus was born of a woman. That's all he ever says, and of the seed of David.
You mentioned this in the book, that when the women are talked about in the book, when the mother of Jesus is talked about in Paul's literature, it's always the woman. He doesn't mention her by name a lot, or women. There are other women involved. Why?
Luke is that way as well. Luke and Paul both, rather than naming the women, mm-hmm. tend to just say the women, like when there's a gathering of the followers of Jesus after his death. Mm-hmm. And all the apostles are named, all the men. And then it says his mother and brothers
Is that because it's a patriarchal society?
I don't necessarily think so. Well, the fact that the apostles' wives aren't mentioned, certainly, but when you say his mother and brothers were also there, yeah. but you don't name them, you're naming both men and women.
You're marginalizing the family.
You're marginalizing the family.
Put your headphones on for a second. We'll take a call very quickly here from Carlo in Charlotte. Welcome, Carlo.
Thank you. I have a brief comment and a question to Mr. Tabor, which I enjoy his work. Don't you think that sometimes this disagreement between biblical literalists or fundamentalists and progressive Christians or whatever we want to call it, historical critics, is reaching a point that it may be kind of useless. I mean, I understand the contribution that actually both sides make, but don't you think that that at some point both groups should meet in an area in which we should move on and understand that the Bible can be historically accurate at times, and other times it's just merely poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to comment on that? I'm running short on
time. Yeah, it goes beyond my book. It's a great question in our culture right now being debated. What we try to do at UNC Charlotte and in most departments of religious studies is not really make those kind of judgments. In other words, what we try to do is take a historical approach to Jesus, Paul, as much as possible, and let people make their own judgments about how literally or figuratively they take those documents of origin.
So we've talked about a lot of the things that Paul has inserted into Christianity, his version of his brand of Christianity has become the salient brand, and that includes points like the forgiveness of sins through the blood of Christ, God's divine Son, are based on his sacrificial death on the cross, receiving the Holy Spirit and the gift of eternal life is guaranteed by faith in Jesus' resurrection from the dead, a glorified heavenly reign with Christ when he returns in the clouds of heaven. All that comes from Paul. But there are other things that come from Paul that have been rejected. His role that his role as the apostle to the Gentiles would bring about the imminent dissolution of the entire cosmos, and that all earthly and heavenly powers would be overthrown in his lifetime and replaced by the heavenly reign of his followers. These were not adopted as beliefs.
I think certainly the apocalyptic aspect was dropped because, as you said rather bluntly early on, it didn't happen. But most fundamentalist Christians would still read those passages and say they're coming sometime in the future.
So in 30 seconds, what are people to take from this?
I think what I would like them to take is Paul in his own words, and then the possibility that behind these words we can still get to a Christianity before Paul and at least examine it and read it.
That is, would we recognize it? Would we buy into it?
Try the Sermon on the Mount and the letter of James. I think it's actually still out there, and many churches would emphasize that.
Dr. James Tabor, author of Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity.